in free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Wednesday, July 16th, 2014. It's the 200th episode of the show. Can you believe that? Man, that happened fast. Well, thanks so much to you guys for listening. If nobody listened, I wouldn't have kept on for 200 episode, so I really do owe it to you guys. That isn't just an empty platitude. Thank you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for spreading the word. Thanks for being a subscriber to the show on iTunes or Stitcher. Thanks for supporting the show at no cost to yourself. When you're about to make that Amazon purchase, that little voice in your head does not mean you need to be in a mental institution. It's the voice of conscience telling you, "Hell, that guy keeps giving you a show every day and you love it. You should maybe make that purchase at TomWoodsRadio.com using the little Amazon widget." Well, today, I'm very glad to be joined by a guy I've known for, I guess about a dozen years or so now, and that's Jason Jewell, who is chairman of the Department of Humanities at Faulkner University. He holds a PhD in humanities from Florida State University, and he is an associated scholar of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Today, we'll be talking about his contributions to a very interesting, intriguing new book called Christian Faith and Social Justice, Five Views. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's the 200th show. You have a lot to live up to here. I mean, you better be darn good or ain't no way you're going to be on the 300th show, my friend. All right.
Well, I'll do my best.
Okay. This book is so unusual in the way it's laid out, in the structure of it. I've never seen a book like this, and that's what makes it so compelling and interesting. The book is Christian Faith and Social Justice, Five Views. You're one of the five views. So first, just explain how this book is laid out. How's it set up?
Well, there is some precedent for a book like this. I've seen one or two books like it that were published back in the 80s and 90s by publishing houses that are mainly interested in exploring theological topics. So I've seen some books like it in the past, but this particular one, we have a general editor who recruited all the people to write for the volume, and each one of us wrote a 6,000-word foundational essay laying out what we consider to be the appropriate view of social justice. And then obviously there was a bit of a time lag here. It took quite a while for us to send the manuscripts back and forth to each other. But once we all completed those foundational essays, we all responded to each other's essays. So I had to write a 1,500-word response to each of the four other contributors. And then I read all of their responses to my essay. And then I wrote a final summation essay of about 2,000 words. So altogether, I contributed about 14,000 words to the volume, so it was a pretty good-sized project, and the other contributors all did the same. So it was a really interesting exchange by the time all was said and done.
Tell us what the other four perspectives are. Yours is libertarian. What are theirs?
Okay, we have a Rawlsian liberal, then there's a feminist, a liberation theologian, and a virtue ethicist, so very diverse viewpoints there. And it was really interesting sort of to read their essays and find out what made these other perspectives tick, I would think.
I want to start off with an overview of your position and how you argued it, and then we'll go through and say something about what their responses were, because their responses to you, for the most part, struck me as fairly uncomprehending. Actually, you know what, before we do that, can you explain to people what a virtue ethicist is?
Virtue ethics is a tradition that goes back to classical philosophy, like Aristotle, and coming up, it's been a lot of a conversation between classical philosophy and Christianity through the centuries. So St. Augustine of Hippo, for example, is considered to be a major voice in the virtue ethics tradition, coming up through a lot of the major thinkers like Thomas Aquinas. A lot of it overlaps with what libertarians are familiar with in terms of the natural law tradition. But this is a perspective that tries to identify, use reason, and to some extent for Christians, revelation, to identify what virtue is, and then try to shape a social order that will encourage people to acquire and cultivate virtue in their own lives.
All right, so let's go ahead and have you give an overview of your, in other words, we'll do this sort of the way the book is laid out. We'll start off with your basic set of claims. And of course, I'd be interested to hear how you define and treat the subject of social justice and, of course, the state. And then we'll look at what these other perspectives are saying.
Okay, well, my goal in laying out the libertarian perspective was, first of all, to try to do some analysis of the institution of the state, try to get people to think about what the state is. Because, you know, in my experience, and I'm sure in yours too, Tom, when we talk to people who are not libertarians, there's sort of this, a lot of assumptions, and the state is just taken for granted as an integral part of society, and we can't do without it and all that. So I began by talking about the state and how it's basically an institution that's based on violence, based on aggression. And then I talked about the libertarian idea of the non-aggression principle. And I wrote this foundational essay last year before a lot of this thick libertarianism versus thin libertarianism stuff blew up on the internet. Mm. So if you were trying to pigeonhole me, I would be putting forward the thin libertarian position, saying that libertarianism is basically insisting on the non-aggression principle, and then beyond that, libertarians disagree on a lot of things. So I was stressing the idea that for libertarians, getting to a just society, first of all, means that you don't use violence or aggression to get there. And after that, then I went through some of the standard boilerplate objections to libertarianism and tried to answer those, and then talk about how libertarianism is compatible with the scripture and the Christian tradition. So it was a lot to do in 6,000 words, and I remember almost tearing my hair out getting near the end, where I tried to summarize the socialist calculation problem and the problem of rent seeking in the public choice school in like two paragraphs and try to make it comprehensible. But I was told by the editor that we had to assume that the people reading this book would probably never have encountered our position before. So we had to try to make it very basic and with as much clarity as possible. So that was the challenge before. But I think by the time I got done with it, it was fairly clear and comprehensible.
One thing that I found interesting was the response by the virtue ethicist to you, because you had made some statements about war that she could agree with, about the use of violence. But then you also said that, well, taxation is violence, and so therefore publicly funded education, publicly funded health care, these are also the fruits of violence, and so therefore we have to reject these just as much. And her response was, She said, you know, but when he, I can stay with him when he talks about war, but when he gets to saying that the tax funding of these things is wrong because it's also violent, then, quote, the mind boggles. So in other words, her visceral response constitutes an argument. She says, no, I consider the public funding of education and medicine to be exactly the sorts of nonviolent Christian responses to social problems that we should celebrate in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Yeah, and I thought that was a major blind spot for this particular contributor, because she identified herself as a pacifist who was opposed to all kinds of violence, but she refused to acknowledge the idea that, you know, taxation involves violence or the threat of violence. So she kind of had this complete disconnect, saying that all this money that the state uses to fund all these activities just sort of magically appears, I guess, and then we can do all these wonderful things with it. So I found that to be a pretty, because in a lot of ways, I liked the virtue ethicist's essay. I mean, she was speaking the same language that I speak on a lot of things in terms of culture and values and virtue and all that sort of thing. But when it came to that question, I found her response to me in particular very disappointing.
I want to read for the audience here a portion of your concluding response. So all five of you have laid out your positions with the other four responding to each one, and then you each get an overall response at the very end. And I just have to share a little bit of this because I think it's interesting to see that even in this academic environment, it's not a formal debate where people are trying to score points in front of a live audience. It's the most sober kind of academic environment possible. You ran into exactly the same problems that people run into when they argue libertarianism over the internet. So let's hear. So you are very generous in saying that perhaps I myself had some preconceived notions of what other people believed when I went into this, and I've had some of those challenged, and I've corrected them, and that's great. And then you say, but upon reading, you say, in the individual responses I wrote to my colleagues, I strove to limit my points to the arguments they themselves made. Wow. How generous. But even so, I fear I may have misattributed certain beliefs, positions, or motives to them. Upon reading their responses to me, I could see that they experienced the same difficulty, whether or not they realized it. And here's what I like. In several places, they have misstated or otherwise reached faulty conclusions about the libertarian position. Several times, they rebutted positions I had not advanced, or in a few cases, had explicitly disavowed. Indeed, one contributor's response to me addressed almost none of the arguments I actually made, and instead offered a string of inaccurate statements about the history and content of libertarianism, before digressing into a lengthy instance of the genetic fallacy, with an attack on the personal character of a 17th-century figure I had not relied on in my essay, and had mentioned only once in passing. And then it goes on from there. Awfully frustrating.
Yeah, so, I mean, the editor was really impressing on all of us the idea that we were supposed to have a very collegial exchange, and this was supposed to be a constructive conversation, and I really approached that idea in good faith, and as you could see from what you read, that was really the spirit that I was trying to bring to this, and trying to find common ground where I could. But after reading some of the responses that I got to my foundational essay, I remember specifically one time, after getting a response from one of the other contributors, I sent an email to the editor and said, did this person actually read my essay before writing this response? And the editor assured me that the person had, but still, it was extremely frustrating. It was like we weren't even in the same room or the same universe of discourse, you know, trying to, when you say in your foundational essay, I'm not saying X, and then they come back in their response to me and say, Jewel is saying X.
Yeah, that's a problem. That's a problem. Well, tell me, of these four other, well, okay, the virtue ethics person you have some affinity with, but you've got three others in here. You've got the liberation theologian, you've got the feminist, and you've got the Rawlsian liberal. Was there any one of those that you felt maybe had a little bit of overlap or that had some good insights or some, there was anything that you could latch on to?
Of those three, I thought that I was having the most constructive exchange with the Rawlsian liberal.
I would think so.
Yeah, and as you know, there are a lot of people in the libertarian camp who like some of the ideas of Rawls and are trying to patch together some kind of coalition between Rawls folks and libertarian folks. And so I talked about a little bit about that in my response to him. And in his response to me, he acknowledged that, you know, maybe I had some good ideas, even though he ultimately disagreed with me when it came to the use of the function of the state. The feminist and liberation theologian, first of all, I found it difficult even to understand what they were saying in their foundational essays. I found their language to be very vague. They weren't defining their terms. They weren't being specific on the kinds of proposals they were advancing. And so a lot of my response to them was really just to say, what are you talking about? What exactly is on the table here, and what do you want to see happen? So I think, you know, we run into that a lot, too, that the people are unwilling to say exactly what they mean because they try to cast this really broad net to try to catch as many people in it as they can without really getting down to brass tacks. And that was one of the things that I really wanted to do in my essay was when someone read my foundational essay, they would walk away with it with no questions about what it was that I was advocating. And unfortunately, that just wasn't the case for a couple of these other contributors.
Yeah, a definite lack of precision there. Can you explain, in case people don't know, what liberation theology is?
It's a system of thought that was very popular in the mid to late 20th century, particularly in Latin America. It's a strain of Christian thinking that was very prominent within some circles in the Roman Catholic Church, and it's very deeply influenced by Marxism. So the idea of justice here involves a lot of redistribution of material wealth, bringing down the upper class and all that sort of thing. So it's, some people have characterized it really as just Marxism with a Christian veneer on it. I think maybe there's a little more to it than that, depending on which author you're reading. But the particular liberation theologian that I was interacting with, he never flat out said, "I want socialism," but he did say things like, the European Americans are too accepting of the market economy and things like that. So I got the feeling that's where he was going with it ultimately.
What's the Christian angle specifically in your presentation? When you were describing it to us, it sounds like a fairly standard libertarian exposition, that this is the nature of the state. It inherently involves aggression. Aggression is wrong. There are things the state does that are bad that shouldn't be done. There are the things the state does that are good that could be done voluntarily. What's the Christian angle?
Well, after you're right in that I laid out the libertarian position first, and then I said, okay, to what extent is this compatible with Christianity? And it seems to me that, at least on the face of it, that there's a lot of compatibility, because you read through the New Testament, there's never any call to violent action. Violence is condemned in many places. And I tried to deal with a few specific passages, such as Romans 13, that always gets brought up when you have this kind of conversation. But I said that if you look throughout the Bible at all the places that talk about the idea of rulers, politics, that sort of thing, I mean, most of the time, the biblical authors are very critical of the state and state power. And there are, I think, a number of places in the scripture and in the history of the Christian tradition where reliance on the state is seen as, a bad idea. I also talked about the reliance of libertarianism on natural law, which is another feature in common that you have with a lot of Christian thought, that the natural law tradition is a major component of Christian thinking, starting in the New Testament and coming all the way up to the modern age. So I say, with all of these, even though libertarian thinkers sometimes are emphasizing different pieces of the natural law tradition than the Thomas Aquinas's, for example, still they speak the same language in a lot of ways. And so I was making the case that based on the scripture and on the history of the church, that there's a lot of overlap between the Christian position and the libertarian position. And I also tried to emphasize that, of course, you don't have to be a Christian to be a libertarian, but this is something that there's a lot of common vocabulary, and it's something that it's very difficult to point to something that you would see would be a clear contradiction.
Can you, in fact, say something about Romans 13?
Well, I spent about a paragraph discussing it, and I knew if I tried to get bogged down in the details of the chapter that I would destroy my word count and all of that. But essentially, Romans 13 is, if you read it in the context of the entire letter to the Romans, it's that passage which tells people, tells Christians to pay their taxes and to obey the powers that be, that the powers that be are ordained of God. The context of the passage is telling Christians that, look, we don't want to give the state or the emperor an excuse to persecute the church. So we're going to be good citizens, and we need to pay our taxes. And we're doing that so that the church can flourish. The goal is not just to be lackeys to the state. The goal is for the church to flourish, and we don't want that unnecessary obstacle in our way. This comes right after the end of chapter 12, in which St. Paul tells Christians, overcome evil with good, and then he goes into this discussion of the state. Well, that tells you right there that maybe what was on Paul's mind is that the state isn't the greatest thing in the world, but that Christians have to deal with it, and that they need to, whether you want to call it staying under the radar or simply not giving the state to some kind of excuse to come after the church. I think that's the overall thrust of the passage. Now, there's some specific language in Romans 13 that says the powers that be are there for good and for some things like that. And I didn't drill down that deeply into the chapter, but I did refer people to Norman Horn's essay on Romans 13 that's on the Libertarian Christian side. I know you've had Norman on the program.
Yep.
And one or two other sources that I think deal with that in a pretty good way.
One last thing, I'm looking at your response to the essay by the virtue ethicist, who says, quote, "Libertarianism is more about the freedom of the individual than the common good of the society," which is, I think, a wrong way to look at it. I mean, sometimes we blanch at the term common good just because it's so abused, but when I hear that, I think of that as being one of the great either misconceptions or caricatures that we're, I mean, libertarianism is not even strictly about individualism. It's simply about the use of violence. You don't have to be somebody who is divorced from his family and living in a hut and having no friends or really thinking of yourself above your friends. Who would want to be around you if you were that sort of person? You don't have to do that and be a libertarian. It just simply means that if you want to cooperate in, let's say, building a playground or establishing something that would be for, in the broad sense of the term, the common good, we have to all agree to it, and we can't beat people up to get them to do it. That's all that's being said.
Yeah, I think that a lot of where that misconception comes, and I think that a lot of people are kind of projecting Randianism onto libertarians. I think that they have in their mind some idea of that Ayn Rand was a libertarian, and Ayn Rand is all about the virtue of selfishness and all of that. And so they just sort of think that libertarians must not care about anybody else, or that they just want to have all the liberty for them to go do whatever they want to do. And one of the things that I tried to emphasize, both in my foundational essay and in my replies to people like the virtue ethicist, was to say, look, we're not atomistic individuals or anything like that. We're just saying that social cooperation needs to be done on a voluntary basis rather than through this institution of aggression. And I was really careful in a lot of the, here are the libertarian proposals. I never just said, for example, wipe out regulation or wipe out all the laws that about drug use and all that. I always said things like replace these with voluntary arrangements, replace them with things that are not aggressive in nature, because that's one of the things that we often get tagged with, that we just don't want there to be any rules and everybody's going to go and there's going to be chaos and everything will be awful. Whereas, as you know, we're always saying, look, there are other ways to accomplish these ends that these other social justice folks think are important. So if we want to have public morality at a high level, there are voluntary ways to do that. Let's not use laws that we ram down the throats of other people.
Jason, how did they track you down to do this volume?
The editor of the volume and I were actually undergraduates together long, long ago. And the idea for the book project came out of a conference panel that he and I did about 3 or 4 years ago at the Christian Scholars Conference in Nashville. So he did a paper on Rawls. The editor of the volume is a Rawls guy, although he did not write the Rawls chapter in the volume. So he did a Rawls presentation. I did a presentation on the non-aggression principle and Murray Rothbard. And we were talking afterwards, and he said, you know, I think this would be a great book idea. We could bring in some other folks. And I said, hey, that's great. You do all the work. So he did all the work, and I came on and wrote the libertarianism chapters. But that's really how the book idea got off the ground.
Jason, by the way, everybody, is a faculty member at mylibertyclassroom.com. Tell people about the course you're going to be working on this summer and what the topic is and what sorts of things you'll be getting into.
Yeah, I'm planning on putting together a series of lectures on the history of conservatism and libertarianism, and I'm going to try to do it in a way that it doesn't overlap very much with Jared Casey's History of Political Thought, but I'll be looking at some 18th and 19th century sort of precursors to modern conservatism and libertarianism, but most of it will be focusing on the 20th century, some of the major thinkers, some of the major events, the groups of people that don't often get talked about, people from the old right, those sorts of folks. But after I drew up the list of lecture topics, I thought, wow, this is a really good body of material, and yeah. I sent it to you, and you seem to like it as well. So I'm hoping that that will turn out well. I'm hoping to have all that done sometime this fall.
You know, there are so few libertarians these days who seem to know their own history, who seem to have read a lot of the foundational texts. There are a lot of people who get on Twitter and on Facebook and unbosom to the world their opinions on all sorts of topics as if no one's ever talked about it before. It's important to situate ourselves within a tradition of thought. That tradition of thought doesn't need to be shackles. We build on the tradition, but you have to be rooted in something so that we're not reinventing the wheel every 10 or 20 years. So this is a very important course. Did I have the idea for it and I commissioned it from you? Is that how it worked? Or did you have the idea for it and you begged me to let you do it? Like, how was it?
You know, to be honest, I don't remember. I know we started talking about it a year or a year and a half ago.
I know what it was.
I don't remember exactly how it came up.
No, I think it was my idea, but in a way you thought of it first because you already teach a course on something like this. And so I thought, well, all right, well, let's make it into also a course on libertarianism, and there you go. So we're very much going to be looking forward to that. The book we've been talking about is Christian Faith and Social Justice, Five Views, edited by Vic McCracken. And our guest, of course, has been Jason Jewell, the most illustrious and important contributor to this important and very, very enjoyable and enlightening book. Jason, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Tom. It was my pleasure.
All right, while we're on the subject of Jason Jewell, I want to tell you guys, what Jason's been up to over the past, I guess, 3.5 years is a 7-year program of systematically reading the Great Books of the Western World series, and it's many tens of thousands of pages. And he's broken it up into a 7-year program, and he reads a little bit each week and comments on it on his blog. So he's been doing it consistently, and he's, I guess, about halfway there. And it's very interesting. You can read along with him if you like. He posts on his blog every week what the upcoming reading is going to be, and then you can read his commentary and then make your own comments. It's a fun way to jump into this material. You've got a guide who's bringing you through it, who's giving you a manageable amount of reading each week. It's definitely worth checking out, and Jason is worth checking out in general over at his blog, which is not devoted exclusively to his Great Books reading project. He blogs about a lot of interesting topics. But check him out over at westerntradition.wordpress.com. We mentioned libertyclassroom.com, where Jason is a faculty member, where you can get courses that are you can listen to while you're driving, you can watch on the screen. They're all in audio or video according to your preference. And we're still running the 50% off special using coupon code Kevin in all caps to celebrate the new course by Professor Kevin Gutzman. So check that out at libertyclassroom.com using coupon code Kevin in all caps. The schedule for this week is a bit up in the air right now because we've had to shuffle some programs around. So I don't know if Ralph Nader is going to be this week or next week. He's a definite. That's not the issue. The issue is the other people that I had scheduled. So whether you're going to get Ralph Nader on Friday or Monday, I can't say right now, but I hope you'll tune in for that and for all the programs here at TomWoodsRadio.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.